This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. That ribbon of highway, I saw love made, that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio Show. Welcome with us this afternoon for a special show that we have, and we are honored to have with us a very prominent and controversial guest today. Here at the People Speak, we think when we speak, we make a difference. Sometimes people speaking means people defending people that seem somewhat indefensible. We have with us here from somewhere in the Middle East, and that's all we can say due to security reasons, the lawyer of Tariq Aziz. Tariq Aziz was with Saddam Hussein in his government and administration, and he is currently being held without charges for about 4 years. Giovanni Di Stefano. Welcome to our show, sir.
Good evening. Thank you very much, Basma. Let me say, regarding Tariq Aziz, His Excellency Tariq Aziz, he is held without charge, and the justification that the Iraqi authorities have for holding him is that they wish to investigate him with a view to deciding whether or not he withdrew passports from the Shia Kurds in 1991. Well, now that's hardly a war crime. It's hardly genocide. It's hardly mass murder. It's hardly a hanging offense, even if he did do that, which he didn't, of course, because he was the foreign minister and the deputy prime minister at the time and had no responsibility whatsoever with regard to internal policies in Iraq. And it's one of the things that has made me really, really angry as to how the system has been abused in Iraq, holding people. There's 23,000 people. The majority of those are held without a charge. And their only offense is that at some stage they were a member of the Ba'ath Party.
Well, Giovanni, as a matter of fact, many believe that Tariq Aziz survived as an advisor to Saddam Hussein for over 20 years due to the fact that he had so little of a power base in Iraq, which represented no threat to Saddam Hussein. And if that is true, then what you're saying falls into reason. I mean, it's quite reasonable that for whatever intents and purposes, but isn't there an associative guilt? Let's face it, Giovanni, when you do work with the likes of Saddam Hussein, and if I'm not mistaken, you consider yourself to be actually a friend of Saddam. There is a certain amount of burden of responsibility that falls on a position of that caliber.
Well, let me see if I can define a friend. I have met Saddam Hussein on three occasions there. And let me say, exactly the same as George Galloway said, I did not sell him arms like somebody in the United States of America who met him on a number of occasions there. A friend is a person that you go drinking with, you play cards with, you discuss football, you go to brothels perhaps there with, you talk about horses. That's what we did not do, any of that there. So although I consider myself, certainly I do become friends with clients, it's not the relationship that I enjoyed with Saddam Hussein at that time there. And if you are to be guilty purely by association, well, then there's an awful lot of people in Iraq that actually should be jailed. Because if my memory serves me right, in 1998 when there was the presidential elections, let's just assume for the sake of argument that 30-40% of the people there were forced at voting for Saddam Hussein. That still leaves something like 18 million people who voted for him freely and wanted him as president of the country. So maybe we should jail all of those people there because they're associated in some way with him.
Well, let me ask you something, Giovanni. Assume for one brief moment that I have no knowledge of Tariq Aziz's history. Why, first of all, the fact that he's being held without charges obviously says something. Why shouldn't he be held?
He shouldn't be held. Nobody should be held without charge. It's what the American Constitution says. It's what the Convention of Human Rights in Europe says. It is the basic elementary principle of internationally recognized jurisprudence that nobody should be held without charge. Nobody should be held without being told why they are being held. In fact, in the Iraqi High Tribunal, Article 20 says exactly that. The problem is that they are not applying their own laws. They pretend with a masquerade of hypocrisy that it is a trial. But, I mean, let me assure you that anyone who goes to the trial at the Iraqi High Tribunal, it is nothing but a farce. I'm not the only one that says it. You know, Human Rights Watch has said it. Amnesty International has said it. Louise Arbour at the United Nations has said it. A number of people, far more reputable, perhaps, than an ordinary lawyer. They are dismayed. They are despondent that the way that this has occurred, the United States of America, England, and Italy, because my own country is at fault to a certain extent as well, went in to Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein because he was doing the very things that they are doing now, that they are allowing to be done. They are saying that he had trials without really being a proper trial, that he had judges that he had paid to do exactly what he wanted. And what is happening is that this regime is worse than Saddam Hussein. Now, that's the problem that I face as a citizen of Italy, as an Italian citizen whose country went into attack unlawfully in Iraq. I have that problem. And people hate us in Iraq. Let me tell you, it's not just the Sunnis. I mean, not just the Shiites that hate us. It is the Sunnis. They hate everybody that is party to this dramatis personae who have interrupted their lives. So it doesn't matter whether I'm for or against Saddam Hussein. It's the very fact that Giovanni Di Stefano is there in Iraq. I go to the tribunal. I visit Camp Cropper. So they don't really care. I am one of the people who has interrupted their day-to-day life. And Basima, let me tell you, there's loads of mobile phones in Iraq, far more than what there was in 1998. Well, there wasn't any in 1998. Loads and loads of satellite dishes. There are cookers. There are refrigerators. There are new vehicles. There are everything, all electrical gadgets that you can possibly imagine. Just one problem. You've only got electricity for an hour a day, running water for two, if you're lucky. There's the problem. It's a real problem, a day-to-day problem that we face, which is why the trials in Iraq are not safe. And if you haven't got a safe trial, you haven't got a safe verdict.
Well, lest I be accused for even a moment of being an advocate of this war, I am not, sir. Giovanni, I'm on your side. I absolutely believe that this was an illegal attack on this country. However, the charges that were brought against many of the deck of cards banditos, as some people have referred to them, Tariq actually thought, because of the fact that he was Christian, would somehow be extradited, because of the fact that he didn't have the political clout and the power to wield any kind of he was basically just there to do what he was told and to present that to the world.
Well,
he felt that he was safe.
I don't agree with that.
Okay, go right ahead. Please go right ahead and clarify that.
I mean, please, I have spoken at length to Mr. Aziz on that. He was the only man that was probably not a yes man to Saddam Hussein. He was a foreign, he advised on foreign policy, was a foreign minister. He was the face, the voice, the look of Iraq around the world, the United Nations, the Vatican, the European Union, everywhere there. He had nothing. He never even attended Revolutionary Council. I've seen the attendance list of the Revolutionary Council, and in 22 years, he appeared three times. So you see, the problem. But releasing Tariq Aziz is also obviously a problem because he knows an awful lot. He has been interrogated by the United States of America, to my knowledge, on 26 occasions. And all they have spoken about, not about genocide, not about murder, not about war crimes, not about moving people or removing, they were talking about George Galloway for an awful lot of the time, and about the oil for food program. They're only interested in what Mr. Aziz may say, which may implicate people, A, at the United Nations, and B, in the United States State Department. Because let us assume that some wrongdoing did occur, something did happen in the oil for food program. Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that there were bribes, that there were. What on earth were the United Nations doing? You know, don't they have eyes? What was the State Department doing? They can spy on you and I even when we are down the garden. They can spy on us a mile down beneath. What were they doing? They must have allowed it. And if they allowed it, what does that presumption mean? That someone got something for it. So that's what they wanted to find out. And that's why Tariq Aziz remains in custody there, because they are afraid he may write a book, he may talk, he may speak with the journalist, he may do something, and he may implicate certain countries in their behavior in the Iran-Iraq war. But let me tell you one thing that Mr. Aziz is not. He is not a, as you Americans call, a snitch, as the British call, a grass, as everybody knows, as an informer. He is a loyal Iraqi citizen. He holds his dignity, notwithstanding the conditions that he's in, his health. He is a man of honor and will not do that.
Do you believe it's impossible? I mean, considering Hashim Reza Shala was recently released after 4 years without charges and without an apology, do you believe that this is possible in the case of Tariq?
Well, let me tell you now, I like you, Basinger, because you got that from my diary, that the important thing, he didn't get an apology. He got a release, but he didn't get an apology. And
I won't let a trick slide because I am deadly against this war.
Well, I know, but, you know, what I find fascinating is this is what I call the arrogance of office. And if you read Hamlet's speech, In To Be or Not To Be, he talks about the law's delay and the arrogance of office. By gosh, that's the epitome of what is happening in America. Now, I don't blame the Americans for this, not entirely. They are participants. They are allowing unlawful things to happen because to stop it, I've spoken with one of the generals yesterday, and he said to me, look, Giovanni, the situation is this. We have asked the Iraqis to release six of the people who are on the deck of cards, because we can find that there's no evidence against them. But the Iraqis have refused, and they've refused because they are scared. They ask, can you imagine a Tariq Aziz? Can you imagine a Taha Ramadan, a Barzan al-Tikriti, if they hadn't executed my two clients? They are potential dangers to reforming the party and retaking Iraq. And it wouldn't be the first time that an ex-leader or an ex-person has ever retaken a country. Look at Haiti.
Now, one of the things, do you think that, but the thing is, do you think that there is a possibility that they're going to release them under this? I mean, what are his chances? Because obviously, he from what everything that you're telling us, there are reasons that he is being held, and the reasons have nothing to do with the fact that whether he was guilty or not, because if no charges have been brought about, then obviously they don't even know if he's guilty or not. How can he be guilty of no charge? So what you're saying here is that there are others that are willing to sacrifice this man's life, keep him in jail, so that they won't be outed. So how do you get around that as a lawyer? What would you? How can you aid in this situation?
Well, let me tell you what I'm doing. You see, in April of 2003, this is quite interesting, although it may be a little bit boring, but I'm trying to make it interesting for people who are listening. Mr. Aziz entered into a verbal contract with George Bush and with the United States government. The agreement was, I will surrender myself without you coming to look for me, providing that you fly my family out of Baghdad into Amman. And that's exactly what happened, because at 3.30 p.m., a C-130 Hercules took Ziad Aziz and all the children and the wife of Mr. Aziz from Baghdad to Amman. They landed there, and they settled there, and that's where they are at the moment there. In return for doing that, Mr. Aziz agreed to be interrogated, and then he would be released. Well, the problem is that Mr. Bush has only partially complied with the contract. So what I intend to do, I intend to go into court in the United States. I can't go for habeas corpus. We've already been thrown out on that. They're going to say no jurisdiction, all of that. We've been through that in the district, you know, in Delaware. We did that with Saddam. We did that. So we're not going to get anywhere along the criminal route there. But where we will get along is I'm going to ask George Bush for specific performance. Now, what does that mean? That means you are asking a man to fulfill his contract. And that contract means release me, as the song goes from Engelbert Humperdinck. Please release me, let me go. And that's what I'm going to ask them. And the courts in America are going to have a harder time refusing that, because it's not a criminal matter. It's in the civil jurisdiction. They're going to say, well, let's look at this now a little bit. You know, Mr. Aziz's family, in 2003, went from Baghdad to Amman in a U.S. C-130 plane. Why? Why would the Americans do that to the family? There must be something behind it, or they're completely crazy, or are they humanitarian, that? So they're going to look, say, well, maybe Mr. DiStefano is right. Maybe there is a deal. Then they're going to look and see, well, we've had 23 interrogations, and Mr. Aziz is still in. And that's the only chance that we have of cracking this nut this way,
so
if we are to go through.
So basically, you're basing the chance of Tariq Aziz's release on the fact that you can prove that there was actually a verbal agreement between President George W. Bush, and Tariq Aziz.
Well, there must have been, because why would they fly only the Aziz family out on the day before, the 24th of April, before Mr. Aziz surrenders himself? You see, this is the problem that Barzan al-Tikriti had as well. He surrendered himself, and lo and behold, you know, he's missing his head at the moment. You know, and he's dead. We have another one of my clients who may be executed. I think, mercifully, we may have been able to stop that. And again, thanks to the Americans and the American military and the U.S. officers, there are a number of lawyers who deal with that. And let me tell you, they do a bloody great job. I have to give it to them, and I can't thank them enough for the cooperation they've given to me, the unparalleled access to information, which a lot of the other lawyers haven't had there, and they also are human beings. They are lawyers as well, and they see this is not right. It's not right.
Giovanni, nothing that our the Coalition of the Willing has done in Iraq has been right. Why is this going to be different? How can justice be served in the issue of Tariq Aziz?
Masima, there's an old saying, you know, in law, that for the average everyday person, the law is applied, but for friends, it's interpreted. Obviously, Mr. Aziz is out of friends at the moment, but he has not instructed me to use the information that I have regarding everything that's gone on. There was a meeting between Rumsfeld, him, and Saddam, and Rumsfeld did take something to Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, he didn't go there to eat turkey. He didn't go there to play poker. They didn't go to drink whiskey. He didn't fly all the way out there for anything. And I was the one that was published that photograph there, and I've kindly reminded them, you know, you are the people that have armed this country to the teeth to resolve your problem. Can you please now simply resolve the problem of those that really had little to do with it? People like Humad Humadi, the Minister of Culture. Let me tell you about Humad Humadi. Really interesting story, this. Now, Humad Humadi was the Minister for Culture during the first Gulf War. He was the one that granted journalists visas to come into the country and to report. He persuaded Saddam it would be a good thing. Subsequent to that, he was sacked because it wasn't a good thing. But put that to one side. During one of his interrogations, he spotted a CNN, yes, CNN reporter during one of his interrogations and his debriefings. So he said to me, Mr. DeStefano, you know, I saw a CNN man. I said, how do you know it was CNN? He said, because I gave him the visa in 1991. So you see, the frightening aspect that's come out of all of this is what we've always suspected as lawyers. There are reporters that are planted that work for the state. This is correct. And not just in America, in Italy. I've seen the dossier Mitrokhin. I have that in front of me. I know the reporters from La Repubblica, from Corriere, from a number of newspapers, all who work for the state. Infiltrators. People who are there to collect information. Now, is it good? Is it bad? Would it help the state? If it helps the state, then who the hell cares? But in this case, Tariq Aziz, Humad Humadi, and a number of other people who really have had nothing whatsoever to do with the internal policies of the country. 4 years, imagine anybody in America, 4 years without a charge. That's all I have to say. 4 years without being charged, what on earth would happen?
When it comes to, you've dealt with, you're considered what they call the devil's advocate. Why take such a highly charged and controversial case?
Well, if someone, you see, the whole problem here is this. It's a question of personal conscience and that. If you allow bullies to get away with things, then one day they're going to bully you. Now, you can say, well, what the hell do you care, Giovanni? You know, you're in Rome, you're in Monte Carlo, you're here, you're there, you're all over the world. No one's going to push you around. Well, you know, maybe. But this is exactly what Britain thought, what France thought, and what Holland thought. All the countries that were ultimately attacked by the Nazis, that's what they thought. It's never going to happen to us, so we'll just turn a blind eye to it. This is your Neville Chamberlain, peace in our time, appeasement. I can't allow that policy of appeasement for me to turn a blind eye, because one day it may happen to me, it may happen to my children, it may happen to my grandchildren, and it may happen to my friends, anyone. And I want to be able to say no, no, no. Like Margaret Thatcher, we will not accept bullies, we will not accept anyone forcing us to do something that is clearly not right. And the attack on Iraq was unlawful, illegal. However, as they say in Ireland, once you are there, I am for the Americans staying in Iraq. Because whilst everybody else pussyfoots around and moots and discusses, I see with my own eyes, if you take the Americans out of Iraq today, you will have not a river of blood, as Enoch Powell said many years ago, you will have an ocean of blood that will spill throughout the Middle East because they are incapable of handling their own security. There is no government, effectively, in Iraq. Believe you me, it doesn't exist. And I tell you why it doesn't exist. When we travel with the Americans escort me everywhere, have a massive convoy there. Their command is, we don't stop for anyone except our own. If any Iraqi police stop, just move on. Once you have a country that say that, you have no law and order. Even during after the Second World War, the American soldiers had to stop for the German police. But not in Iraq. And let me tell you, thank God, because maybe otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you now.
Let me ask you, at one time Tariq Aziz was noted as saying that when Saddam died, so did the heart of Iraq.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Saddam was ready to die, and I remember his last words, what he said before, when we saw him before a couple of days before, he said to me, remember, Mr. Jolan, he said, it is easier to kill a man with a smile than with a gun. I'll never forget that. Some great words from the great. I mean, he knew his fate. He knew. We all knew. Everybody knew that Hitler had to die. Mussolini had to die. It was necessary, whether they liked it or not. You couldn't move on. It's impossible. Can you just imagine a Saddam Hussein that is still alive in jail, a little bit like Noriega, another one that is, you know, due to come out. Was he coming out, not coming out? Does he want to go back to Panama? If he does he have support? He had to die. He knew that. But he died as a sacrifice to his country. He did not want Iraq in a situation where there would be civil war. He was against kidnapping. He was against violence. Believe you me, he was. Now, you may not believe it. People listening may not believe it because they've been infiltrated by CNN, Sky News, and all that Rupert Murdoch nonsense that's come out there. But even some of the hard, fast reporters that I see, he died for Iraq, and many people died spiritually with him. Tariq Aziz is one, he's a broken man. So is Sulmat Hamadi. So is Kemal Ali, Al-Majid. They maintain their dignity, but they're broken men. Barzan Al-Tikriti, I saw him the day before he died. He hugged me tightly, and he said to me, Giovanni, when will I see you again? I was seeing a little boy. And he knew that the answer was never, or in hell, or in heaven. God knows where I go. I have no idea, even if it exists. But wherever, maybe we might correspond by email, if I'm in hell and he's in heaven, or I'm in heaven and he's in hell. It's sad. It's sad, Bassi, because I have to deal with these people who I know are going to the gallows the next day. Taha Ramadan hugged me so tight that I'll never forget that. I can still remember his smell. And it wasn't fear. It was just, what's going to happen? Are they really going to do this? Awad al-Banda, Judge al-Banda, had nothing to do with on the Court of Appeal, he was one of the judges that voted against. The other two, who were Shiites, weren't even charged. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Giovanni, we have a question coming through on one of our lines. And for those of you that would like to ask questions of Giovanni Di Stefano, please call our international toll-free number at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Our first caller is Bobby from California. Bobby, can you please give us your question for Giovanni?
My understanding, and from what I read in Middle East papers, over 1,200 lawyers from around the world and the Middle East volunteered their services to join the defense team. What was the process of choosing or allowing the lawyers to participate? I know most of them were denied access to their client, and they were all qualified to defend on their behalf, on behalf of Saddam and his colleagues. Your mic.
Well, it is the client that chooses. It is not the lawyer. Lawyers volunteer. But if we'd have had a situation where there are so many people there, there was a trial once in America, I think we've got it, with about like 30 defendants and everything. I mean, like, you had more lawyers, 60 lawyers, and it was already unworkable, almost unworkable, that situation there. But it is the client, always the client that chooses. There were more than 1,200 people, 12,000 people that volunteered from all over the world there. And, of course, obviously the family thank every single one of them considerably. But at the end of the day, you know, a situation was faced where this was a trial that it didn't matter if it was Effley Bailey, it didn't matter whether it was George Carman, it didn't matter whether it was Shapiro, whoever. Saddam Hussein was going to be found guilty. It's one of the reasons why I issued an arrest warrant in England against Judge Rahman, because he violated the Geneva Convention Act. He allowed a political influence on a judicial process. That is a criminal offence. And let me tell you what Mr. Rahman, Judge Rahman, did. He was in London for a while, and while I pushed Lord Goldsmith, who was then the Attorney General, he ran so fast, like a rabbit down a hill on a promise. That's how fast he ran away from England, because he was scared of being arrested. Now, if you do that and you're scared, and if he was truly innocent.
Hello? Giovanni? It seems we lost our connection with, well, folks, we're trying to get a reconnection. Of course, as we said, our guest is currently in the Middle East. We're not allowed to say where due to security reasons, and it's understandable in such high-profile cases. We're going to go to a short break right now, and we'll be back as soon as we reestablish.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, away, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on...
Hello, everybody. Welcome back, Giovanni. We understood that this could have been a problem due to the phone lines in the areas where you're at.
As I said to you, there are loads and loads of electrical gadgets, but no ruddy electricity to... but there you have it.
Very tragic. We do have a caller on line four. Mike from Florida has a question for you, Giovanni.
God bless you. Thank you.
Mike, are you with us?
Yes. Hi. Thank you so much for this gift. I mean, it's rare that we actually hear somebody from the Middle East talking about this on such an intimate level. I would like to ask the guest, since you've seen so much of what has gone on since the invasion, etc., do most of the Iraqi people, in your opinion, hate the American presence there? And what would your solution, or what do you see as the solution for this? For this problem of the American presence in there, would you just like a pull out?
Well, thank you for the question. As I said, the Iraqi people, like any other person, hates anyone that has infiltrated, that goes into their country and has ruined their day-to-day life. The day-to-day life includes going to school, picking up your children, going to the doctor, going to the hospitals, going shopping if you could find food. It's as inconceivable as it may be, it's difficult to get petrol in Baghdad. So you see, anybody, myself, you, journalists, Americans, it doesn't matter who they are, even some of the Iraqis who have a uniform, anyone who interferes with your day-to-day life is not a welcome person, is a persona non grata. And that is the tragic situation in Iraq. Now, what is the solution to all of this here? Saddam Hussein was the only leader of Iraq that ruled for such a long period of time. As Tariq Aziz said to me, yes, he was forceful. Yes, we had to be strong. Yes, we had to make some controversial decisions, but all decisions that Saddam took were for the greater good of his people. And there isn't a darn person, not a single person in Iraq who, with his hand on his heart, can honestly say that life in Iraq today is better than under Saddam Hussein, except maybe 16 government ministers who don't live in Iraq anyway. They spend most of their time at the Intercontinental Hotel in Jordan. They have their houses, their mistresses in Jordan, in Syria, and other countries there. And they fly backwards and forwards only if, as, and when necessary. And how do I know? Because I meet them all. And I see them all there. So that is the problem. But the average everyday person, the school teacher, the doctor, the dentist, the architect, they are basically... stuffed. They are in a problem. And this is what has aggravated me, because America, let me tell you, the organization is fantastic. They have over 3 million meals per day. The military are superb. They are great. If anybody ever had to take over a country, let me tell you, I've seen different countries. I've been in different war zones. America is the one that I want to take over my country. Their organization is superb. They haven't got a damn clue what they're doing, and they work on a day-to-day basis. They wake up one day and they think, well, we'll do this. That's typical American government. They have no forward planning. There isn't a minister that plans the future in America. They just go on a day-to-day basis, because that's how the country has been raised, on a day-to-day basis. Let's see what happens.
And yet, Giovanni, you say that you think that they should stay in Iraq.
Absolutely.
And the Iraqis don't want them there.
They may not want them there, but let me tell you, their withdrawal... I mean, I'm a defense lawyer, and I should be saying different, but I know what will happen. The moment the Americans leave, there will be an ocean of blood being spilt. An ocean of it being spilt there. Forget about the 100 that die every day. We will be talking about mass murder. And the Americans leaving may very well be deemed genocide, because they know what will happen, and they will abandon a country that they, I mean, they created the monster. They're the ones that created it. I mean, you know, they really should read Frankenstein, because they've created a monster, and now they've got it out of control. Well, they better well, you know, have someone who has some forward thinking and find a solution. Now, what that solution is, I don't know, because I'm not a politician, thank heavens. But one thing is for certain, it better well be legal, because there's going to be a lot of challenges otherwise.
We have another caller, Josh from Miami, Florida. Josh, can you take give your question to our guest? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm really glad to be able to speak with someone from the Middle East who really knows what's going on. In listening, my heart goes out really to the Iraqi people. And I mean that. But, you know, I'm thinking solutions. What is the best way that, or the best thing that America could do for Iraq right now to make things better over there? Or, you know, I'm thinking in terms of the beginning of putting Iraq back so America can get the heck out of there. And one other question. Why do you really think that it's hard for America, or why are they so steadfastly not thinking about leaving Iraq? Do you think it has anything to do with oil? I've heard from many people that America has, as one of the benchmarks, that they will have Iraqi people to sign over 80% of their oil for the next 30 years. I will. And I'd just like to get an answer on that. Thank you.
Well, what is the solution to all of this there? Let me tell you first the mistake that the Americans made, and this was confirmed by a top high-ranking general in the military. What they failed to consider when they occupied Iraq, they dismissed the army and the police. All of a sudden, you had millions of people that were in uniform who knew what to do, who knew the administration, and who were out of a job. And therefore, they had to take over that role. Now, they don't speak Arabic. It's difficult to read, so you don't even know where you're going if you don't read Arabic. So, you know, there was the first basic problem that was made. Even the Americans never made that problem in Germany. They didn't disband the German army when they occupied Germany. They didn't disband the Japanese army. The problem was right from the beginning, because Mr. Bush, Rumsfeld and co. had no... They knew they could take over Iraq, but didn't know what to do with it. It's like the price for a piano. You know, there's one thing, it's expensive, but try selling one. You know, you can say it's an expensive piano, it's a great piano that I've got, but try selling it. You know, it's a very difficult situation that the Americans... Then they found themselves with a real hot potato. And the American military are great. And I say so, I told my clients that. They may or may not want to hear, I owe my life to the U.S. military. They protect me, and they stand in front of me when the moment that I hit Baghdad, they are there. And let me tell you, we've had a few scrapes, and we've had quite a few very, very dodgy occasions. All us lawyers have been threatened with murder, not just to be killed in an order like you kill a normal person. We've been threatened in the most evil fashion because we stand up. We had the courage to go into Iraq. People like Issam Ghazawi, Munib, all my colleagues. I've got young lawyers, Muqtad, Badr al-Banda. We have a number of people, all with young families. All of us have been threatened there. Now, the problem that America needs to resolve is not how to get out of Iraq, because they're in. They're going to have to take the country properly back over, and do the best they can to put a proper government in. Because this government is a non-government. It's a government that tells its judges what to do and what judgments to give. That is a rogue government. And the only reason that the United States of America, in the Constitution, it is enshrined that you can carry arms. Let me tell you why. When that was drafted, it was in case you had a rogue American government so that the people could rise and be equal to a rogue government. That's why you have the right to carry arms, to bear arms in your Constitution. For that reason. Now, somewhere along the line, everybody thought, Iraq's got a constitution now in 2005. Well, let me tell you, that piece of paper you could take to the toilet because it's not being respected. Not one article of that has been respected. So either, at least the American constitution is respected, at least you have a proper way of testing it up to the Supreme Court. You don't have a way. The average everyday person in Iraq can't go to court, can't find a lawyer, can't even find an apple, never mind about a banana, can't get petrol. You can't find petrol. Even the US military sometimes aren't the facilities, the generators break down because we're out of petrol. And I go crazy, I can't understand it. I said, you people came here to steal the oil and the petrol. Now we haven't got any. You know, and it makes no sense whatsoever.
You know, we do have a guest question here, and this is from Leith Munir. Leith is an Iraqi and wants to know why Aziz was captured, and you've already answered that just for those of you that, in fact, there was a verbal agreement between George W. Bush and Tariq Aziz to take his family out of the country, and he would surrender for questioning. He was not found guilty because he's never been charged. And do you believe in the fact that whether or not he will be released is contingent upon whether Giovanni and the lawyers working for Tariq Aziz can convince a court of law that there, in fact, was a verbal agreement. Now, the other question that might... How much of the percentage in Iraq are vying for the release of Tariq Aziz or Hamadi or any of them?
Well, let me tell you, I can best deal this with on the question of Saddam Hussein. We reached a point in December where half the population of Iraq were for him and half were against him. Now, the only problem is that half is 13 million people. That's a hell of a lot of people to have on your side. Is the glass half full or half empty? That's where the problem lies. The Americans go out, you've got 13 million against 13 million. That is one big problem. We're not talking about supporters of 500,000 or 100,000 or that. We're talking about half the population. Half support Saddam, the Ba'ath Party, and that, and half are against him. That is a problem. So what must we do? Must the Americans be like in Cyprus, where we have the war for the last 30 years between the Greeks and the Turks? No, that's no solution. That isn't going to work. We have to restore some form of unity. And here's me talking like a politician, and I can't stand them, to be quite honest with you, because at least we may, as lawyers, we tell the honest mistruths. They tell mendacity at its highest level. In substance, they are liars. All politicians, most politicians in any jurisdiction, they tell lies at election, they tell lies after the election, they tell lies to the electorate, and they misrepresent as has happened in Iraq. The situation has been, and in Afghanistan, it's been wholly misrepresented. But put that to one side. Now we're in this cauldron of mess. You know, it's only thanks to America that there isn't a bloodbath. So I have to thank them on behalf of those people, at least, who, you know, who I represent, who support. Otherwise, let me tell you, it's, believe me, an ocean of blood. And I see it in the eyes of people from the moment that I hit Baghdad there. Sunnis, Shiites, Kurds, they all hate us. They all hate everybody that has destroyed their country.
Sounds like a pretty desperate situation, as we all agree, no matter which side of the fence that we're speaking on. We have another caller. Bobby from California has called back. Bobby, if you would keep it brief, thank you for calling back.
Sir, from professional life and my practice in management, I learned if you are the problem, you can't be part of the solution. And you identified the American invasion and subsequent occupation of Iraq as the problem. How can they be be part of the solution? Next three.
Well, again, a political question. Then now I may have to change profession sooner rather than later, it would appear. As a matter of pure law, international jurisprudence and common sense, which perhaps should prevail over everything else there, the Americans are the ones that have caused the problem, so they must resolve it. You can't let the Iraqis, because the way that the Iraqis resolve their problem is, have you noticed one thing? When people get killed, it's suicide bombers. It's not like people throwing bombs and killing other people. They kill themselves and 50, 60 other people. Do you understand the desperation level that a person goes to where he plants a bomb on himself, he knows he's going to die? It's not just about faith or about or all this nonsense about religion. It is the desperation level that they are prepared to do whatever it takes to bring attention to a cause there. It's the they're the ones that worry me. The suicide bombers who have in their heads, it's instilled in them there, that it is so desperate that they are ready to die and take other people with them to bring attention to the problem.
Giovanni, if I may interrupt for just 1 minute. What we're saying here is that we have a most desperate and depressed situation, one that was specifically caused by the actions of the government of the United States, along with the coalition of the willing, that because of this desperation, people are taking desperate actions.
Well, that's
isn't
right.
Isn't that exactly what is going to continue to happen? Unless
it will continue.
We're not taking any control.
Well, today, a chief cleric was murdered. Let me tell you, there's going to be retaliations. Make no mistake about it. They're not going to allow that to go unpunished there. But it's not the retaliation that we expect in the West. In the West, you know, I defend people. I mean, they send killers out and they kill, they throw a bomb, they stab people, but they don't die. Here we have a situation where a person daily is prepared to die to kill other people. We've never come across this before. Never had that in Germany. Never had that in the Second World War. We had the kamikazes to a certain extent. But they were the fighter pilots. But we rarely had anybody that had a bomb around their chest daily. This is a daily occurrence. Not once in every on the death of a pope. It's a daily occurrence, and it's frightening. Because it can happen at any time.
You know, one of the things that we have to understand is, again, under such desperate situations, there's an issue of dying or dying loudly. If I'm dying anyway, if I stand the risk right now for being an Iraqi in Iraq is unfathomable. No one trusts anyone. The common man doesn't trust the Americans. They don't trust the Iraqis. They don't trust their government. They don't trust any military police militia that may be in existence. So what's happening here is their voices are being lost due to the inadequacy of an occupation that should never have happened. How do they speak out? And who do they speak out to? If the Western forces, the coalitions of the willing, were the ones that brought this reign of horror upon them in the first place. It's mild, I think, to suggest that this is just an interruption of their lives. Since the beginning of the first Gulf War, between sanctions here. Well, there's an estimation, this is a conservative estimation, of over 3 million people dying in Iraq.
Well, I think that's probably correct there. I know just one thing. Whenever I'm heavily escorted with 20 vehicles, so I'm in one of the most protected people in Baghdad there, and I thank the Americans, of course, for that there. I see the desperation in people's eyes. I see the desperation there. I don't know what the solution is. I just know that there is a problem. I am a lawyer. I do the very best that I can for my clients. I see people who are unlawfully detained, who are 4 years in jail, who shouldn't be in jail, and no matter what, you know, someone should have the courage to say, we got it wrong. See, this is the problem with the American government. America is a great country, fantastic country, but they have one major fault. They never admit a mistake. Now, that is inherited, unfortunately, through the British. The British have never said sorry in the same way that if ever you give money to a political party, you never get it back there. And it's something that someone should start addressing sooner rather than later, because today it's Iraq. Tomorrow it's going to be Korea, or it's going to be Zimbabwe, or whatever country someone wakes up to. But if a mistake has been made, what in God's name is wrong with saying, sorry, we got it wrong, how can we put it right, let's work together? That's what I ask. I ask the judges sometimes, if you got it wrong, why don't you just say so, reverse your judgment, and let's not waste time going to the Court of Appeal and keeping people in jail. Tariq Aziz is 4 years, 3 months in jail for nothing, without a warrant, without a piece of paper holding. Humat Humadi has never seen a judge. Madness. Absolute pure. That's not what we went into. We didn't. No one went into Iraq to be worse than Saddam Hussein. At least Saddam Hussein put people out of their miseries, shall we say, if what the prosecution says is right. He gave them a trial and he executed them. At least there was something that occurred. Now, it may not have been right, but there was something. In this case, people are allowing Tariq Aziz to die in jail. That's what they want. They want him to die in jail. And I've had to call the medics twice out. This man is ill. Believe you me, I mean, I'm afraid. I see what he coughs up when he talks to us. Humat Humadi is ill. I have a letter from the son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, who also is in custody there 4 years for nothing, without a charge, who wrote and said, look, I'm very worried, Mr. DiStefano, about Tariq Aziz. Well, we're all worried. But why is all his friends have disappeared? Because, you know, in the political life is very much like men when there's trouble in the household. We quickly run away and leave the women to look after the children and to resolve the problem. We're cowards deep down, men are, when we're fronted with domestic problems. And it's exactly the same thing that has occurred in political life. The moment you're down, boy, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, ain't no one going to come near you. It's a lonely life. And that's what's happened, and that's a tragedy. Because he did many favors for people, I know. And anyway, if anything does happen to Mr. Aziz or to Humat Humadi, I have a documentation full of stuff, and that's going to come out, because I'm not going to let his death go unpunished and go be forgotten.
From the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. And I went that ribbon of highway, a salt of May, that endless skyway, and I saw below.
Hello again, Giovanni. It seems we're fraught with our problems today on the sound. We apologize for the connections.
It's all the fault of AT&T or whatever. We've got to blame someone.
Well, I know that we've kept you a little while, and we appreciate your talking to us. It seems like there are a million questions yet to be asked. We can take a few more minutes.
I've got
if you'd
few
like.
Myself.
Great, wonderful. Let me ask you about Osama bin Laden. You did have a brief encounter with Osama, did you not?
In 1998, on March the 24th or 25th, I can't remember the precise day there, when Butler was there as well. I've subsequently learned, of course, when I spoke to the president, that he was certainly a persona non grata. Now, whilst he wasn't treated rudely or expelled from the country, he certainly did not receive an audience with His Excellency President Hussein. He did not receive an audience with Taha Ramadan. He did not receive an audience with Barzan al-Tikriti, and definitely did not receive an audience with Tariq Aziz. He was there for that period of time, and he was very quickly made clear that he was not welcome in Iraq, as opposed to being very welcome in Serbia, because I have a copy of his passport when he was there in 1980. So he was there buying arms on behalf of the American government there. And I've got the documents, I've got the passport of Osama bin Laden, and I've got the file notes of the meeting with the arms company in Yugoslavia there. So... Iraq did not make him feel welcome at all. And when
As a matter of fact, Giovanni, if I'm not mistaken, from everything that I know about the ideology that Osama bin Laden believes in and everything that I've read about Saddam Hussein, they are actually the antithesis of each other. They absolutely have nothing in common in their belief systems.
Well, you often find that people who are, if you can call them insurgents, or those that are anarchists, or people who want to challenge a lawful authority, they have a way of finding themselves in very strange countries. Take, for example, Carlos the Jackal Sanchez. I mean, he was in Oman, he was in Sudan, probably the last places that you would think that he would... But, you know, for a number of years he was there, and then, of course, his guard was slipped, and, you know, he finds himself in a jail in France, sadly, and facing further charges, incidentally, as well, you know, because his time is almost due for release. So what do countries do when they don't want to let anybody out and their time has expired? Well, they just think of new charges.
Exactly.
Could have thought of those years ago, but, you know, we might. Same with Noriega. Noriega.
Yeah.
He should be out. You know, France has no business issuing extradition warrants at the last moment. He was in custody for 11 years when they tried him in absentia. Where in God's name were they previously? These are politically motivated.
Going back briefly, what I want to know, how often do you actually see Tariq Aziz under the circumstances?
Oh. Very regularly, and as necessary. I mean, we have absolute access. And again, thank you to the American military. It is the U.S. military. It's the RCLO officers. It's the liaison officers in Iraq. Without them, we would be dead meat, let me tell you. None of us could even walk about. You don't walk about anyway, but you couldn't go anywhere. If you don't have a U.S. military. Even when I go to my embassy, the Italian embassy, I'm heavily escorted. It's too dangerous because people see us as people who have disturbed their day-to-day life. And that is not good.
Do you think it's just because of that, or do you think that the fact that you're defending what many perceive as the indefensible?
Well, no, it's... You see, because I see the faces of Sunnis and Shiites. They have exactly the same look. They may have a different credence, but they have exactly the same look. A one of saying, you know, what the hell are you doing here? Why have you come here? Why is this process going on? You're a foreigner. I'm a foreigner. I'm Italian. My country, you know, Berlusconi, my president, you know, put our troops in with the UK and the US, the fool. I mean, he's my friend, but I mean, you know, in this case, I mean, I heavily contest him.
Giovanni, I don't know how much you've been following the recent events surrounding General Petraeus.
Very much so. He's a great guy. A very, very nice guy.
So you have met him?
I'm not going to say whether we had formal meetings or not, because that may compromise positions, but just
I
say that
understand.
He is a superb man. He is the right man in the right place, and what a pity he wasn't there years before.
And so how do you feel about what's happening to him currently between the Democratic... He's literally being used as a pawn right now to somehow further advance the presidential candidates' positions.
Well,
do you think that's fair of Americans to turn on Americans just for doing what we've asked them to do?
Well, this is, of course, the politicians interfering with the military. Unfortunately, the structure of our society, the judicial structure of our society, is that the president is the head of the armed forces, which is not pretty bad from a person who actually didn't have such a good reputation in the U.S. military anyway, George Bush. So it's a little bit like Hitler, who was a corporal who ended up in charge of his own country and in charge of the armed forces. But, you know, I'm not saying, of course, that George Bush should be compared to Adolf Hitler, because he's actually not such a bad person, Bush. He's misguided. He's got it wrong. And instead of going back like Nixon used to and like Roosevelt was a great man for saying, well, guys, I got it wrong. Shall we do something else? Shall we try something? No, this man goes all the way forward until he takes you to the profundest pit of hell, which is all very well if... You know, you are not the one that's going down with him. The problem is you've got 300,000 people that face death daily. 3,500 people murdered in Iraq. 3,500 families, which if you multiply at least by 10, because a family unit is almost 10, that's a hell of a lot of people crying today.
Absolutely. Some of Tariq Aziz's thoughts upon the execution of Saddam Hussein.
Can you repeat the question, please?
I was saying, what were some of Tariq Aziz's thoughts upon the execution of Saddam Hussein?
He shed tears. I mean, he you know, he was not ashamed to cry. Awad al-Bandar, when I went to see him in January, a few days after that, he read from the Quran before we did anything. They were all worried more about Saddam and Iraq than themselves. Every single one of them, and it was really quite something, I have to say.
And are you involved with Tariq's family right now? Do you speak to them often?
Oh, of course, yeah, regularly to Ziad. Let me tell you, Tariq Aziz, for example, Ziad was arrested in Iraq during the period that his father was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. You know, young people do stupid things. He did some stupidity-ness there. Saddam Hussein, he couldn't get an appointment to see Saddam for 16 days. And when he did do, he never even spoke about his son. His son stayed in jail for 9 months. So that's how the system used to work there. We're talking about Tariq Aziz's son in jail for a stupidity in us, which the president could have easily picked up the phone. No, because the law was the law. Taha Ramadan's son-in-law was in jail for 2.5 years. Now, Taha Ramadan was the deputy vice president.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You see, the law worked. It may have been not to our liking, but it worked. It was functional. Nobody was exempt. You may say, well, there are executions. There's more executions in China. They've just executed a man for taking bribes. My God, If you did that in America, you'd have half of America. In fact, there'd be no electricity. The currents would go down because there'd be so much electricity using the electric chair.
Is he afraid now that the executions have started for his own life?
I didn't detect fear in anyone who faced death in Iraq. I do not, not even Al-Mayyid, the man better known as Chemical Ali, you know, when he was sentenced, he said, I can't repeat on the air, but the polite word is, thank heavens that I can get you judges out of my hair. But it was far more coarse and far more rude. That's how he felt. You know, at least it is over now. You know, thank God, get you out of my, you know, my way. And
now, Chemical Ali's relation. Now, you also defended Chemical Ali. Let me ask you: when we talk about Tariq Aziz, many years felt that his position was not a position of that could compromise the country, compromise the position of Saddam Hussein. Chemical Ali, on the other hand, had a very, very powerful role in this. How do you justify the defense of Ali Hassan al-Majid, who is considered Chemical Ali?
You see, the thing is that I had access to an awful lot of documents. We knew 2 months before the sentence or the judgment that he was going to, that three people would be hung, one would have life imprisonment, and one would be acquitted. We knew before the trial had even finished, because we were told by the Americans, we were told by the prosecutor that that's what would happen. We are told before the appeal was decided that Chemical Ali would hang in Anfal. I mean, excuse me. You know, if that is going to be the situation, then what is the point? You know, the trial is superfluous. Why not do what the Italians did in 1945-46 up to 1948, line people against the wall and just shoot them? At least you put them out of their misery, and we don't have this hypocrisy, masquerade of hypocrisy, of saying we are doing things just. At least they've stopped saying that now, the Iraqi government. They used to say that. It was a justice, it was a just, it was a fair, because it's rubbish. Not fair at all. You can't get any evidence in. They wouldn't let us do post-mortems. Now, this is just, for 1 second, please listen, it's very interesting. Now, people say that in Anfal, people were gassed, okay? That is what you understand, isn't it? That 100,000 people more have been gassed, doesn't matter by who, but they died by gassing. Is that correct? That is what the average everyday
according
person
to,
understands. Yes?
According to the media reports, yes.
Okay.
But this is the traditional media reports that we get here. Although we know that generally on the ground, it's a far different picture from what is translated into our mainstream media here.
Let's just assume, let's go with the prosecutor that they were gassed. Let's go with the average Anfal is synonymous with gassing. Now then, if that is the case, in any court of law, any court, from Rwanda to Zimbabwe to the United States to Italy, cause of death, I asked for postmortems to be performed, autopsies, I asked for excavations, exhumations, to see the cause of death. No. All we had was the evidence from one person who survived the so-called gassing, who survived it, and who lives in Holland, who wanted to sue the Iraqi government, and who went to a doctor in Holland and said, this person suffers from the results of gassing many years ago. That is the only evidence as a matter of law. So the prosecution say these people died by gassing, but there's no evidence of that, because we were not allowed. They wouldn't hear of anything like that, at least in the Milosevic trials in Racak. I was there when they did 114 postmortems, the Finnish pathologists, and they then decided that the people who died in Racak didn't die there. They were dragged there. Why? Because there were scratch marks on their legs. And so it wasn't quite what was made out by the prosecution that people were lined up against the wall there and were shot, and that in Racak there were 77 teachers that were lined up against the wall in there and that were shot. Well, when we had a survey, when we had the census, there weren't 77 teachers in the region. Never mind about in a small Racak that had less than 1,000 people. What would a small place with less than 1,000 people do with 77 teachers? So you see, it's a question of admissible evidence and a question of evidence. And that has not come out. And there lies the problem. People have been condemned to death on an unfair trial, on a system whereby it was predetermined, the destiny, and it would have been a lot easier if it just shot them. You know, there'd be onings and ahrings, I would be complaining, Louise Arbour would be shouting her head off, quite rightly so, at the UN, all of us, but at least it would be over and done with. There'd be no pretense.
One of the things that I've often also I think people are forgetting, and although I personally am not an advocate of the methodologies that Saddam Hussein used, I'm not a believer in over-demonizing Saddam Hussein either, because I think that people place certain value systems on the way a person dies. If you are killed by mustard gas, it's much, much worse than having been blown to smithereens due to a bomb. Under those circumstances, one of the things that many people do forget is during that period of time, the Kurds actually were creating a coup to overthrow the Saddam government. Now, I've often said, if here in the United States a militia revolution started and the militia tried to overthrow the government of the United States, what would we do in response?
Well, we've seen that in Waco, didn't we? We saw the results of one sect. That
I like the way you said that. It was really Waco.
Well, I mean, it was. I mean, we saw the results of a religious sect that didn't want to comply with the edicts of the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
We gunned them down. Men, women, and children, we gunned them down. And that's the point. The point is that there was a coup. They were trying to overthrow the government. They were enemies of the state, and they were dealt with. Many people believe that because of the way that they were dealt with was horrific, and I often wonder, what's horrific about dying? You know, does the dead man really care? Ask them. Was it better to die being blown to smithereens or to be bombed with mustard gas or to whatever it is? The fact is, the dead man doesn't care at that point, I think.
No, well, that's the whole point, you see. It's the politicians that make a decision based upon their own intuition, because most of it is intuitive. The attack on Afghanistan, I remember Tony Blair getting up on Sky News and saying, I have a 20-page fax with outline proof that Osama bin Laden is responsible for the September the 11th bombings in America there. Now, we've never seen those 20 pages. And a fax, if you don't mind, it came by fax of all things there. And based upon that, they attacked Afghanistan. Now, the Taliban, and believe you me, I'm no great follower of that. They were democratically elected.
Yeah.
The people wanted them. You know, yet we removed them simply because Osama bin Laden's son married the commander of the faithful's daughter on that basis. Well, I mean, if I understand it, Ms. Bush is getting married to someone else or was engaged shortly. You know, I mean, so if some country doesn't like it, do we attack America? Italy. For example, we in England, there are members of the Red Brigade who have been tried, found guilty of the Bologna railway station bombing, where 89 people died. Now, the British courts have refused to extradite to Italy because 89 deaths is political. If you kill one person, it's criminal. 89, it must be political, because obviously, why would you kill so many people if it wasn't political? So what should Italy do? Send its F-16 bombers to England? Which is what exactly we did in Afghanistan, because the Taliban wouldn't give Osama bin Laden.
Well, that would be the logical conclusion based on
exactly.
the processes that we are are using currently to attack nations.
It's going to rebound on the children of America, because America is a great country. It's not a bad country. But America, wherever you go in the world now, from a leading country where you could go, you could be proud with your passport after the Second World War, in 60 years, it has become a hated nation. And it's not the people that are at fault. It's the government. And again, it is why enshrined in your constitution is the right to bear arms. It was there in case you had a rogue government, so the average everyday citizen could get themselves together and could take arms against a rogue, uncruel and oppressive government. That's what it's there for, then. I'm not saying advocating that people should do that there, but the government had better be careful.
But in fact, that was what our founding fathers...
protect the citizen.
Yes, in fact, that's what our founding fathers had decided upon when they instilled the Second Amendment.
Let me tell you, who was... Basim, another piece of statistic, I mean, like people say, we lawyers talk. Who was the very first terrorist? Let me tell you, with a wanted post, George Washington. Why? Because he opposed the lawful authority of George III. He was the first terrorist. He was the first wanted post. Wanted post that was against him.
And here we are years later, they've become our heroes.
Exactly. So you see, yesterday's terrorist is probably today's hero. So maybe in 300
Well, look at the IRA, Giovanni. Look at the IRA. They've dropped more bombs than most of the terrorists have ever done in the history of terrorism, and they're now a legitimate part of the government.
Well, they are Sinn Féin, although there is a sense of detachment. But I mean, I do act for some people who have been accused of very, as you know, in Ireland. I mean, I represent some fairly serious people there. And but again, let me just. For 2 seconds, tell you a little bit about that. When I had a meeting at Portlaoise Prison with the four different factions, which can be called the Irish Republican Army, on the offshoots of those, the Inla, the that, it was the first time in years that the four people had got themselves together in a room. So I said to them, what is it you're after? You want a free Ireland? Well, you got it. The European Union passport allows you to go anywhere. You haven't got a border between Northern Ireland and that. What do you want Northern Ireland for? You've already got a United. You've got a United Europe. You've got more than what you bargained for. And if you can't organise yourselves together as an IRA, how on earth do you want to take over the government of Southern Ireland or Northern? It's impossible. So, you know, there's been some communication in the last 2 years as a result of that. It's why communism will never work. Russia and China, both communist countries, could stand each other.
Yeah.
Don't work.
Sounds like a macrocosm of the Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. Let me ask you one question. I know we're getting near the bottom of the half and we'll be ending, and we really appreciate that you spent this additional time with us. One of the things that I would like to ask you is, upon the release of Tadek Aziz, we wish to have you back and hopefully discuss any of the aspects of the case that you have liberty to discuss. And let me ask you one more question. Nuri al-Maliki. What are your thoughts
on Maliki,
him?
Yes, Mr. Maliki, yes. Mr. Maliki, 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 Maliki. Yes, well... As Tony Blair says, there you have it. When you can't find an answer, that's what he says. There you have it.
Now Giovanni, you're sounding like a diplomat.
Well, I'm trying to do my best. One of the great men in Iraq, and I was criticized by my colleagues, was Salem Chalabi. Salem Chalabi was responsible for the formation of the Iraqi High Tribunal and for the principles and the statute. He is a great man. I don't give a damn who criticizes me from my team there. He is a truly great man. He had dialogue with me in London. We dealt as colleagues. He was not my enemy. He was my adversary. He's a great, great man. And I told everybody, anybody lays a finger on this man, I walk away from this case here. Because we are not killers. We are not, it is not personal. We are lawyers. He is a lawyer. He is responsible to do a job. He is not that. And thanks to him, and when the government didn't like what he was doing because he wanted a proper tribunal, he wanted international judges, he wanted a copy of the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague. That was his aspiration. And when he saw that he couldn't do that, he walked away. And I say, Salem Chalabi, you are a great man. You know, a great, and I respect and honor that man there publicly.
And Nouriel Maliki.
Well,
I know you're trying to evade this.
It's easy to ask me about Mr. Sharif, you know, Sharif in or Mrs. Bhutto in Pakistan. I mean, we basically have a similar situation.
I rest my question on that. I think we have gotten our answer. Touché. Thank you very much, Giovanni. Folks, this was Giovanni DiStefani from some parts in the Middle East, the attorney for Tariq Aziz, and we hope to have you back upon the release of Mr. Aziz. Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen of our listening audience, our guest next week and the People Speak will be Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. We hope to see you and hear you all then. Thank you very much for your calls, and be well, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Giovanni.
God bless you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you. Call me anytime.
Bye-bye, my friend.
From California to New York, from the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. That went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley. And I said, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert. And all around me, a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property, but on the other side it didn't say nothing. Oh, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, this land is mine, land from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.